Thank you, Dr. Federley. Our reading for the chalice lighting comes from the author Glenn Pemberton in his book entitled Herding with God. We live, he writes, in a world that is beyond our control, in a life that is in a state of constant flux. So we have a decision to make, a path to choose. Do we keep trying to control a storm that is not going to go away? Or do we start learning how to dance to the rhythms of a changing world? And now, Brooke. Pam, thank you for that beautiful story about such a difficult subject. And it was so poignant and so beautifully offered. Thank you. I'd also like to thank Brooke for standing in for Mignon bravely. And I hear that she plays a mean ukulele, for those who wish to learn more about that. And last but not least, Laura, thank you for emerging from the rigors and vigors of recent motherhood to lead our service today. We are on a journey that we did not create or design or consent to, but by taking birth, by being born, by being introduced to the world, we are on our way on a journey that has a beginning and a middle and an end, and a release into a mystery from which no witnesses have returned. And it seems from cradle to grave we are enwrapped in mystery and in wonder. If we have time and patience to see that. No one has a journey that is like yours or mine. The journey of every person here and of every human being is unique. There may be people who are very similar in character and personality and circumstance, but the specifics of your journey have never happened before and will never happen again. And this entire journey took 4 billion years to develop. And we are nature conscious of itself, and nature with the ability to communicate with other beings about many things. Other people are with us on the journey, spouses, friends, relatives, children, grandchildren, grandfathers, grandmothers, people who cross our paths either favorably or unfavorably. And their journey affects our journey the closer the orbit of their life is to us. Our journeys mix and mingle with many others, especially those we are related to and those closest to us by kinship and friendship. We compose a story about ourselves. We are the main character of the story. That's one reason we love stories so much, is they are integral to our way of being in the world. And as we're young especially, we dream dreams and we look at our lives spread out ahead of us and have certain hopes about the future and how our story will pan out. We soon discover, however, some of us at a very young age, some of us in middle life, and certainly some of us as we draw close to the end, that things happen. Many things happen that we have no control over, that we did not bid to come into our lives, that are in many ways unwelcome. Some of these events can be devastating and shattering and frightening. As a minister, I have seen many examples of that. Chief among those things which frighten us and devastate us are the loss of loved ones. So, part of the journey of life and the story we are telling ourselves and others is that things happen that change our story, that force us to make turns and twists and detours that we do not want. Grief is our response, our human total response to anything which seriously disrupts the story we had planned for ourselves and our loved ones. People who experience loss find out that other people, sadly, quite often, have a limited capacity to hear what they are enduring. They learn that people don't want to hear about their pain. They would rather hear an unending series of happy things. On top of individual losses, there are societal losses, catechisms of history that touch us. The pandemic has touched us, has made us aware of losses, has created divisions that we did not know were there, and that in turn created problems. Many groups in our society experience a special kind of loss and suffering. Black people in this country experience a degree of loss and suffering far exceeding white people, and they suffer the additional anguish of knowing that on balance, white people prefer not to hear and do not want to see and are even offended by the insistence that their daily disproportionate excess of suffering is there. The disparities of grief increase grief, but life moves on. It does not stop. It does not pause and wait for us to feel better or be better. It does not wait for us to figure things out. All the while, there is no expiration date for grief. There is no removal of grief by magical thinking or in any other way. No one grieves the same, but some articulate people have striven to try to describe what grief looks like from the inside. And one such person is C.S. Lewis, who wrote in his masterful book, A Grief Observed, the following. Grief feels like fear, he wrote. Perhaps more strictly, like suspense or like waiting. It gives life a permanently provisional feeling. It doesn't seem worth starting anything. I can't settle down. There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want others to be about me. And don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion, or I shall suspect that you do not understand. The difficulty in dealing with grief takes all kinds of detours because it is very difficult for a number of reasons for us to face and to deal with it squarely. Grief goes into anger. I think that much of the anger in our country, which, as we all know, lives in abundance in many ways in our country is rooted ultimately in grief of all kinds. Unresolved grief leads to silent shutting down, to isolation, depression, into illness. Some people get stuck in grief. And like someone leaving, never leaving their house, never go outside the confines of grief. Some people get stuck in asking the question, why? And someone, they might find someone who will tell you, oh, I'll explain to you exactly why it happened and have some belief, but it is of no benefit. Some people all their lives are in search of the question, why? Why me now? Why this person? But in the end, there really aren't any reasons defined. If grief is not a problem that can be solved or a thing that can be left behind us, then what do we do with it? And if we don't want our grief to seep into the very marrow of our bones and poison us, what do we do with it? If healing and renewal is possible, what form can that possibly take? Vicki Harrison wrote, "Grief is like the ocean. It comes on waves, ebbing and flowing. Sometimes the water is calm, and sometimes is overwhelming. All we can do is to learn to swim." But what does it mean to learn to swim in this way? There's a Buddhist story about a woman who came to Buddha and said, "I've lost my husband and my child, and I am filled with inconsolable grief. Can you help me?" Because someone in the village had said, "Go see Buddha. He is a great wise person and he can help you with your sorrow." And so the Buddha listened to her and then said, "I can help you, but here's what you must do. You must go to any house in the village or in the villages nearby and take from that household just one mustard seed. And if you bring that mustard seed back to me, then I can help you." And the woman, with considerable relief, ran out of the hut where they were and began to go to each household. 3 days later, she came back. But before she had left the house, Buddha had added one other thing. He said, "In the house from which you take the seed, it must be a place which has never experienced a great sorrow." And so the woman was not deterred by those last words she heard from the Buddha, but she began to go around to the houses. But 3 days later, she came back and said, "Buddha, I didn't find any house that had not been visited with great sorrow." So the first thing we need to do with grief is to understand that it touches every single person. There is a habit that is habitual to us and automatic to us in this society, in which we work diligently to keep others from seeing our grief. We may even hide it from ourselves for shame that we have grief that is not yet resolved. Because for many of us, there is no upside to sharing our grief with another. All we will do is face the indifference or the smirks, perhaps, or the lack of comprehension of another, or worse. So the accumulative effect is that in our society right now, there is a subterranean world of unresolved grief, which we do not disclose to one another, or perhaps only to a rare few. Our grief, meanwhile, shows up in anger, unexplained anger, striking out at others, cutoffs, depressions, illnesses, and myriad other ways. So the first step in grief being a healing force is to realize that every person in this room, every person you will see today, every person you will see this week, and any person you might view on TV or social media is someone who has been struck, affected by great suffering, and that they are hiding it from everyone else. The second point of healing, of tapping the healing force of grief, is that grief can be the greatest teacher of compassion that we will ever experience. Grief helps us understand how fragile life really is, how vulnerable we really are, and how we are all in the same boat. The most compassionate persons I have known are those who have been deeply touched by tragedy, blinding, terrific tragedy, have faced it and used it as a way to know in themselves and to express to others a compassion for what? For the sorrows of the human condition. The poet Rumi stated, "Grief can be the garden of compassion if you keep your heart open enough through everything. Your pain can become your greatest ally in your life search for love and wisdom." Finally, have faith that there are people who care, and you can find those people. Find someone to talk to. Be careful in choosing who it is, but find that person or persons. One of the greatest assets of this fellowship is that there are people who deeply and profoundly care. Sometimes I think the greatest thing this congregation could do for itself is put a huge neon flashing sign out where that house that we tore down was and say, "Welcome to a place where people care about other people." And that alone would, I think, bring droves of people to this place in a society that is inundated with indifference and hatred. The caring committee, the staff, the lay ministry program of this church, and in other ways, provides great, great service of caring. There is absolutely nothing we can do to take away a person's grief. However, we can be present. We don't leave grief behind. Many of us think about grief as something we put in a box and we try to contain it, and we're trying to lock down that box so that we can, or maybe even bury it so we can go over here and be with people and be happy with other people and leave the grief buried. But that isn't the way life is. We don't leave it behind, we carry it with us. Closure is a made-up construct. Resilience isn't stoicism, but the weaving of grief into the very fabric of who we are. Our grief is, whether we like it or not, the cost for being alive and being a conscious being. Grief teaches us compassion. May we all find the peace that is beyond all understanding. Our reading today is three brief readings from three different authors. The first is actually an author team, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and David Kessler. They write, "We do not get over the losses, the great losses of our lives. We learn to live with it. We will heal and we will rebuild ourselves around the losses we have suffered. We will be whole again, but we will never be the same." And from Mary Sarton, in her Journal of a Solitude, she writes, "I think of trees and how simply they let go, let fall the riches of a season, how they can let go and go deep into their roots for renewal and sleep. May we imitate the trees. May we learn to lose in order to recover. And may we remember that nothing stays the same for long, not even our most intense emotional pain." And finally, from Thich Nhat Hanh, a great spiritual leader throughout the world who passed away about 2 or 3 weeks ago, he wrote, "It is possible, of course, to get stuck in the mud of life," by which he meant the sorrows and sufferings of life. "The hardest thing to practice in this life is to not allow yourself to be overwhelmed by despair. When you're overwhelmed by despair, all you can see is suffering everywhere you look. But we must remember that suffering is a kind of mud that we need in order to generate joy and a deeper happiness. For without this suffering, there's really no deep, genuine joy, peace, or happiness. We have to learn how to embrace and cradle our own suffering and the suffering of the world with a lot of tenderness. In each of our practices, we center around the world, and in every place that we have a teaching facility, we have a lotus pond. We know from experience that we need the mud for lotuses to grow. That if you don't have the mud, the lotus won't appear. You cannot grow lotuses on marble. Without mud, there can be no lotus. If you know how to make good use of the mud, you can grow beautiful flowers. If you make good use of your suffering, you can produce genuine peace and joy. These two are always linked. If you have a strong hankering to be an office volunteer, there are opportunities for you. You will find a link this afternoon on the fellowship website to help guide you in your path. And now, the words as we extinguish the chalice come from Reverend Maureen Killoran, who wrote, "May life bring enough challenge to stir your soul, but not overcome it. Enough affirmation to honor your gifts and who you are and provide a path forward. Enough nurture to give you peace and resilience for the living of your days. Believe in your life. Believe in all those who you love and care for. Follow what is true for you. Respect what is true for others. And know that always, when you return to be among this people, you will find outstretched hands of healing and hope. Amen.